MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
It is a Tuesday afternoon, and each Tuesday afternoon we look forward to having a chat with my good mate, Dr. Ross Walker. Hello, Ross.
G'day, mate. Lovely to talk to you.
Likewise. How you doing?
Oh, I'm very well. Very well. Busy, but very well.
Looking forward to a break over Christmas, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's been a very, very busy year, I think, for everybody, and I just think this break will be very welcome for all of us.
And are you going to your usual spot?
Oh, yes. I'm a serial offender when it comes to Byron Bay, so I'll be up in Byron Bay for quite a few weeks over the Christmas break. In fact, I'm going there this Thursday for a few days.
Good for you. Good for you. Let's get stuck into it. I see that masks for COVID, and, well, if you look at the figures, I mean, let's not joke about this. The figures each and every week at the moment for people coming down with COVID keep going up and up and up, don't they, Ross?
Yeah, they do. But I interviewed a fellow called Clay Gollidge, who's one of the top infectious diseases experts in this country, and he works in Perth. I interviewed him on Sunday night and about this very subject, because it's Western Australia where they've brought this nonsense back about wearing masks. And he basically said, look, there's no evidence to show that standard surgical masks do anything. They last for about a minute, and then they're not protecting anyone against anything. He said the only thing that works are the N95 masks, and he said that that's a big hassle to put those on. They cause all sorts of issues. So he wasn't happy about it at all, and he didn't think it should happen, and he's more of an expert along those lines than I am. But I said, look, does it really matter for people who are in high-risk areas? So it's only really for high-risk areas. So we're talking about parts of the hospital where there's other issues, such as people have had organ transplants, people are in intensive care, those sort of things. And I think it's okay for that, but I don't think we should get to this nonsense of people having to wear masks in supermarkets again or on public transport. I mean, the fellow who was the I think it was the chief medical officer of Western Australia, but don't quote me on this, I'm not exactly sure, suggested that everyone who went to the Coldplay concert should wear a mask. I mean, can you believe that?
Probably, if it's, was it a politician that said it?
I think it was a health professional.
Oh, well, yeah. Because health professionals are sort of in the back pockets of politicians, I suppose. Some of them, anyway. And yeah. I can understand them saying things like that. It's stupid.
Yeah, I still see occasional peanuts who wear masks outside, which is just crazy. There's absolutely no physiologic sense behind that whatsoever. The worst one, I think, and we've all seen this, is the person sitting in a car by themselves with a mask on. I mean, what on earth are they thinking?
Or the person who wears the mask but only has it over their mouth and their nose is exposed.
Yeah, that's good too. And as Clay said the other night when I interviewed him, they last for about a minute or two, and people just wear them all day. It's just nuts.
But if they only last for about a minute or two, what does that say about them being worn all the time in operating theatres?
Yeah, I don't know. It's concerning. Maybe surgeons should wear N95 masks. I don't know. It's not my area of expertise. I sort of bow to the knowledge of people who are much much more educated in that area than myself.
Ross, a boy has swallowed 21 disc magnets. A teenage boy as well, not a baby boy. A teenage boy swallowed 21 disc magnets, and so they've done a case study on this and documented it.
Yeah, well, I put this in my weird file, because can you imagine? But the weirdest thing is this teenage boy said, I had no idea how they got there. Really? Yeah, a lot of people turn up to accident emergency departments with things inside their body suggesting, gee, I fell on it, or I don't know how it got in there. And it's a similar thing. What sort of idiot would swallow 21 disc magnets? And they had to pull out three were embedded in his stomach wall, three were embedded in his large intestine, and 15 more were in various parts of the large and small intestine, causing small holes. I mean, this guy could have died had it not been picked up. I just thought it was madness. The sort of things some people do to their bodies, you just can't believe.
And you know the really stupid thing about it is, apart from the obvious, by the boy doing this and the procedure to get everything out of him, this could affect him for the rest of his life.
Yep. He could be left with serious gastrointestinal issues, even when you've had something like this, if they've had to operate. So a lot of these things could have been taken out with a colonoscope and a gastroscope, but you can't get to all parts of the small intestine with that. So if they have to operate, then down the track, especially with this sort of extensive surgery, there's a great risk of a thing called adhesions. And when you get adhesions in your bowel, then the bowel can get caught in those adhesions and you get a thing called bowel obstruction. So this fool, as he gets older, may have recurrent bowel obstruction. So it's also looking at the public purse, the hospitals having to pay for this nonsense, but also the misery this poor guy is going to go through as he gets older. I just don't get what people do to their bodies.
A new test to detect worm cancer could prevent 87% of women who do not have cancers from needing invasive diagnostic procedures. This is what a new study has found.
A study out of the University College London looked at this blood test called WIDQEC, the name doesn't matter, which is a simple blood test for uterine cancer. So there's cervical cancer, which is cancer obviously at the outlet of the uterus, and then there's the body of the uterus is uterine cancer. Totally different causes. So we know cervical cancers, they're talking about a potential cure throughout Australia now because of the wonderful cervical cancer vaccine. Or cervical cancer vaccine, not cervical, it's the spine. Cervical cancer vaccine. But also that just the fact we have very good surveillance for this now. But this uterine cancer is a completely different cancer causing different issues. And up to now, the only way to have it diagnosed is in women, typically perimenopausal, postmenopausal, who present with vaginal bleeding. They have to have ultrasounds, either a transvaginal ultrasound or abdominal ultrasound, and then almost certainly a curette, which is an invasive procedure. It's done under anaesthetic, of course, but it's still not a lovely thing to have done to you. And now this blood test is going to give a much better predictive risk for the people who do or don't need that test. So I think it's a big deal.
Yeah,
and should be available very soon.
Offering population-wide genetic screening for risk of deadly but preventable diseases to young adults would save lives. Now, this is a study that's been done by Monash University in Australia, and it would also be, according to their study, cost-effective.
Yeah, and it's interesting because they only took three relatively common conditions. So it wasn't as if they did full DNA screening of people. They targeted three main genes. So one gene was the Angelina Jolie BRCA1, BRCA2 genes, which obviously gives you a marked increase for breast and ovarian cancers. Familial hypercholesterolemia, which is where people who might eat a reasonable diet or bad diet or a good diet, but still their cholesterol sits somewhere between 7 to 10, and they could have no body fat at all, but their genes push the cholesterol up to that level. And the final thing is a thing called Lynch syndrome, which I actually saw a fellow last week with this thing, where they have multiple polyps throughout their bowel that can turn cancerous. So they did this screen through Australia, people between 18 to 40 years old, three different genes, and found that 1 in 75 people are at high genetic risk for one of these conditions. And they did 10,000 adults they screened, and they found that it would be cost-effective to actually do this. So I think it's one of the things of the near future, not the distant future. I think in the next few years, we're going to see much more accurate genetic screening for all sorts of diseases. And to be frank with you, mate, I think we should be doing this probably when people hit around 30, because can you imagine you get this brand new bouncing baby in your arms and somebody comes and says, oh, we just checked the genetics on this child. They've got a 40% chance of having breast cancer through their life, a 90% chance of having cardiac disease, and a 65% chance of getting Alzheimer's. Who wants to know that when you've just been given a baby? But at 30, I think it's a good thing, because that's when you start to get a bit of common sense about your health. A lot of 20-year-olds just think they're bulletproof and treat their body quite badly. But I'm not saying they all do, so please don't bring and abuse me if anyone thinks I'm saying this to everyone. But when people hit 30, that's when I think they start thinking about their mortality. They're starting to develop responsibilities. Maybe they're married, they've got kids, and they start to think, gee, I've got to look after myself a bit better. And I think that's the good time to start to think about having these genetic screens when they become available.
I suppose this raises the other subject of, on this, if you could know, would you want to know?
Well, yes, I think you do. I'm obviously a great proponent of screening because we're not victims of our genes. We are the masters of our genes. We can do something about it. And I believe that 90 to 95% of modern diseases are completely preventable. So if you know that you're at high risk for heart disease, obviously you practice the five keys of being healthy. You might get your cholesterol lower, have your blood pressure treated. If you're at high risk for Alzheimer's disease, all the risk factors for heart disease are the same risk factors for Alzheimer's disease. You get those managed well. But see, a lot of people abuse their bodies. They get into their 60s and 70s. They start getting diseases. They start doing something about it. Yeah. The earlier you know, the earlier you start, the better off you're going to be.
A large Swiss population study revealed decreased sperm concentration and total sperm count with increased mobile phone use. Is this a male problem? Of course, it's a male problem. I mean, so yeah. Males, listen up. Be careful if you're using a mobile phone too long.
Yeah, well, what they did is they studied just under 3,000 males, 18 to 22, and looked at their mobile phone use, a 13-year study. And they found that if the males only use their phone once a week, as opposed to people who use them more than 20 times a day, and I would suggest to you there'd be much more people who use their phones 20 times a day rather than the people who just occasionally use their phones, there was a significant increase in sperm abnormalities, sperm concentration, sperm count, sperm motility, which is how well the poor little things swim. And it just, I'm not saying that mobile phones are dangerous. I'm saying this is putting some question about the whole thing. But interestingly, with this study, those who are using the lower G network, so 2G, 3G, now we've moved to 4G and 5G, they seem to be much more efficient phones with less radiation. So, but still with all of these things, I think we should keep the phones away from us. Some people keep them in their pockets the whole time. And I had one woman ring one of my Melbourne radio segments, and she said, when I was talking about this is 5-6 years ago, and she said, you know what, doctor, I always used to carry my phone in my left top pocket over my left breast, and I got a breast cancer right underneath it. That is an anecdote. That is not a clinical trial, but still it's a pretty disturbing story. So I think, yes, we all need phones, we all need to use them, but don't use them that much, and keep them away from your body most of the time.
CT scans, a CT scan, a risk for young people. What age?
Yep.
What age are you when a CT scan is not a risk for you?
Okay, well, firstly, this is yet another conversation about radiation. But look, I think there's only three advantages of being over the age of 50, Brent. One is wisdom. Two is grandchildren, if you've got them. And three, you lose the cancer risk from medical radiation. Okay. So, and I'm not saying I've got proof or huge studies on this, but I'm just saying from my experience, I don't have a problem with people having CT scans beyond the age of 50. But up to the age of 50, I would limit it. Now, this study was only in people below the age of 22, but it followed 1 million people for a follow-up, some of them up to 20 years, but the average is just under 8 years. And they found that even one CT scan can increase the risk for a cancer down the track by about 16% up to the age of 22. But the reality is, for every 10,000 children who have a CT scan up to the age of 22, there are 1 to 2 extra cases of cancer in those children. Now, that's not a lot, but if you're the person who gets it, when it was unnecessary that you had the scan in the first place. So the point I'm making from this is that if you're going to have any sort of radiation up to the age of, I think, 50, but certainly up to the age of 30 to 40, and they want to do CT scanning or nuclear scanning, you must say to the doctor, are there any alternatives to this? So, for example, an MRI is no radiation at all, has no harm to the body. An ultrasound, no radiation, no harm to the body. So I think we just have to minimise the radiation in younger people, unless it's vitally necessary.
Okay, good advice. Being taller throughout life may protect against heart disease and stroke. They're talking in this article about being tall when you're young. I thought, yeah. If you're tall when you're young, aren't you tall when you're old?
Typically, yeah. Tall children become tall adults, typically, but not always. But it usually is very common for that to happen. But interestingly, what they're saying is if you're tall throughout your life, especially, you have much lower rates of stroke, coronary artery disease, peripheral vascular disease. But if you're tall throughout your life, or if you're a tall child, regardless of your adult height, but you typically will become a tall adult as well, you have a much higher rate of what we call dissected thoracic aortic aneurysm and atrial fibrillation. So different genes that make you tall, different genes that make you shorter, will predispose you for different medical conditions. And it doesn't mean that you have total protection either way, or a definite risk of getting the disease either way. It's just a higher risk if you're shorter of getting the vascular problems, and a higher risk if you're taller of getting the fibrillation and the dissected aorta.
Just a quick question before we go from Ted. He says, are side effects with statins serious, e.g. muscle, kidney pain, liver damage, heart problems? Do they do more damage than help?
No, it just depends. Again, if your coronary calcium score is above 100, or you've had a stent bypass or a heart attack, there is a definite benefit from being on a statin in addition to looking after yourself. So everyone should see their care 80-10-10. 80% is how you look after yourself, lifestyle. 10% is pharmaceuticals if you need them, 10% supplements. But if your calcium score is zero or below 100, you don't need a statin. So don't even think about statins. The side effects are annoying, hardly ever life-threatening, but the annoying ones are muscle aches and pains. But I've seen people been on statins for 20 years. They've got no muscles left. It just eats away to their muscles. Now, that's anecdotes. It's not clinical trials. If you believe the stuff that's been put through major journals, there's no major link to long-term damage in statins. But they're selected people. I'm talking about a cardiologist who's been working for 40 years. I have seen people long-term on these drugs get some problems with their muscles, not so much with their liver, not so much with their brain, but I have seen people get a lot of symptoms around those lines.
There you go, Ted. That's an answer for you. Always good to talk to Dr. Ross. Thank you for your time, mate. We appreciate it immensely. We've got a couple of weeks left before Christmas break, haven't we?
Yep. We absolutely have. I'll talk to you next week.
Look forward to it. Enjoy a couple of days in Byron, mate.
Thanks, mate. I certainly will.
Okay. We'll talk to you next Tuesday. Thank you as always, Ross. See you,
bye.
Mate. Bye-bye. That is Dr. Ross Walker.